One, hold the paper up. One, two, three.
You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, January 2nd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Ladies and gentlemen, I know it's 2014, but we've got one more best of 2013 helping you, hopefully, with your now fading hangovers, or in my case, just doing chores around the house. 2014, ladies and gentlemen, who knew? Who knew it could be like this? And I'm sort of guessing, because it's actually still 2013 when I'm recording this. But I cannot believe these newfangled devices they have in 2014. It's crazy. Are
they available on Credo yet?
I don't know. Actually, the Credo deals have ended, but for us. But there's all sorts of newfangled devices. Apparently, they have a vacuum cleaner that is automatic. You can just let it run around. Yes. It's amazing.
Oh, we're going down this path, huh?
Yeah. Animals can speak now, 2014.
Is there anything that can shut your kids up?
No. No. I imagine by this point, 2014, Saul's already learned to speak. He's complaining to me.
And
he's
expresses disappointment.
Expresses disappointment. Dada, you annoying.
You run a what? What do you do for what?
We get it already.
Podcast? What?
We know that you know what the Republican man is going to say on TV. We get it, Dad.
Yeah,
please,
exactly.
More baby food. Thank
yes.
you.
All right, so folks, for this best of 2013, one of the things that I think really defined 2013 was the biggest austerity measures that we have seen in quite some time in this country. And to talk about how misguided that is, we have an interview from Professor Mark Blythe from April of 2013 talking about austerity, the damage that it had done up to that point, particularly in Europe and on the verge of doing to this country. Good interview. I think you'll enjoy it. We will be back live tomorrow for the first time in 2014. Cliff Schechter will be joining us. I don't know who else will be joining us, but enjoy this interview. I don't know if Matt will have dropped in some extra bonus stuff, but onward and upward, folks, in 2014. Here's that interview now with Mark Blythe.
Happy New Year.
Oh, yeah, and Happy New Year. I forgot.
Happy New Year.
And forgive me if I only say Happy New Year and not Happy whatever it is that Fox has a problem with the way that I say Happy New Year. All right, so here's that interview with Mark
Blythe. What about all the old years?
Right, yes, indeed.
I'm so restless, some bold as a cat. I'm so We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the international political economist from the Watson Institute at Brown University, Mark Blythe, author of the just-released Austerity, the History of a Dangerous Idea. Thank you for joining us today.
A pleasure to be here.
So, Professor, I mean, let's start with this audience is fairly familiar with the broad outlines of why austerity is problematic. But before we get into why this idea will not die and from whence it came, please just walk us through the three problems that you outline with the problems with austerity.
Sure, there's three general problems. Sometimes these are seen as like the Keynesian response, but honestly, there's nothing Keynesian about it. It's pretty much commonsensical. The first one is distributional. Let's remember the fact that all the way through to 2006, I don't remember too many Republicans jumping up and down about the increase in national debt to 61% of GDP brought on by tax cuts and wars of choice that weren't funded through any taxation. So then Obama wins, you have a financial crisis, you bail out the banks, and then the net effect of that is to push you up to about 80 to 85% of GDP. Now, at the end of the day, you've got 100% of GDP, everyone's freaking out, and the solution is we need to cut back Social Security. So there's a simple question of equity as well as an underlying one of causation. Why is it that when you bail out some of the wealthiest members of societies and basically give asset protection to them and their incomes, the people who have to pay for that are the people at the bottom end of the income distribution who rely on government services? This is a bait and switch of humongous proportions. The second way that it's a problem is compositional. While it makes sense for any single family or firm or even a country to reduce its debt, that is contingent upon having an income from which to save. If everyone simultaneously contracts, as is going on in the Eurozone just now, the net effect is to increase the stock of debt relative to the size of the economy. As the economy contracts, tax receipts go down and the debt gets bigger rather than smaller. And the third one, to riff off Paul Krugman for a moment, is that the confidence fairy story really is a fairy story. The idea that business confidence comes rushing back in response to government cuts, if you go through the formal models used by economists to justify this, it actually says the following. Despite the economy falling about your ears, despite the fact that you might not have a job next week or you don't know if you're going to be able to pay your mortgage, the government has decided to slash 30% of public spending. You now know that 20 years out you're going to be paying less taxes. Buoyed by this, you decide to spend lots of money in the future now, thereby curing the recession and the depression, despite the economy falling about your ears. That is the definition of a fairy story. So there's a question of fairness and equity and causation. There's a fallacy of composition about doing it all at once, which simply doesn't work. And the last one is, it's a fairy story.
I want to just focus on the fallacy of composition, because just walk us through the relationship between the government carrying debt at a time when everyone else is trying to deleverage, and vice versa, and that dynamic right there, which flies in the face of what we're told when a family has to tighten their belt, then government should too. It's just the opposite.
Yeah, although I just said, you know, it makes sense for any family or even a state, there really is a categorical distinction going on here. Let's just think about this for a moment. When a family decides to save and stop spending, it presumably still has an income from which it can save. It cannot issue its own currency. It cannot issue its own debt. Usually, it cannot bring people into the family and tax them across generations to be credible payments for that debt. States can do all that. And when you are the United States and you issue your global reserve asset, which everyone invests to when the economy is in trouble, the dynamics are kind of different. So the whole thing about it is just like a family, right? Whether it's the Swabian housewife of Angela Merkel or Mrs. Thatcher who used to invoke that, or Republicans today, that is a nonsense story. But the more important point, the more important way of thinking about it is the following. Imagine that the economy is a fraction. Let's say you've got 80% debt to GDP, which sounds like a lot. So 4/5 is a fraction. Now, let's say the government decides that it's going to take out 20% of all expenditures in the economy. It's going to cut its spending in half, really credibly commit to this policy. Then what you've done is you've basically turned 4/5 into 4/4. You now have a 1 rather than a 0.8. You've got 100% debt to GDP. That is what's happened to every country in Europe that has undergone an austerity program since 2010. They have more debt rather than less, even controlling for the recession and the effects of the financial crisis. This is self-defeating. We knew this from the 1930s. In the 1930s and the 1920s, the Brits tried to cut and cut and cut and cut. In 1931, they had, if I remember correctly, 150% of GDP, debt to GDP. By 1933, they had 170, despite the cuts.
Now, what do you make of the argument that we will hear that, well, in that example you gave of four-fifths, the bottom line is if the government stops borrowing money to fund these its spending, then it will open up the opportunity for the private sector to borrow that money and put that money to good use.
Well, that's the classical notion of crowding out, right? Now, if what's happening is the government's borrowing all the available money and there's no money left for the private sector, you should see that real interest rates will rise because, crudely, that's the price of money. And what do we have? We have real interest rates on the floor. Now, you can come back and say, well, that's because Bernanke is suppressing the real price of capital. But if you look around the world, interest rates are on the floor everywhere. Meanwhile, business is sitting on enormous stockpiles of cash. And if you look at it, you'll find that corporate profits, even during this recession, have never been higher. So the idea the government's eating up all the available capital is simply incorrect. They're borrowing money that is out there because people want to hold the global reserve asset because the world is fundamentally uncertain. That's what's going on. This is why companies are sitting on large stockpiles of cash, because they don't know that investing just now is going to reap the returns that sitting on basically a reserve asset gives you.
Before we get into the history of this idea of austerity, we also just speak briefly about the impact that that trade has on this dynamic. When we look around the world right now, we're seeing how austerity is destroying Europe. It is at least taking a hold in this country to a certain degree, a lesser degree, and is at the very least slowing down our recovery. But give us a sense of what the implications of trade are also on this dynamic.
Well, trade's very important if you are, and this particularly in the case of the European Union, you've got lots of countries that are all tied together with a common currency, and you are each other's major trading partners. So if they all decide to cut at once, that old four-fifths turning into four-fourths, then what you do is you shrink the regional economy overall and actually make the situation worse. So if you're heavily interdependent with trade, then trade becomes a channel through which austerity compounds effects rather than makes things better. If you look at the EU's reports on this, they say that austerity is working, and one of their indicators is that people are importing less and they're exporting more. Well, we can't all run a surplus. We can't all export at once. What's actually happened is that imports are shrinking because the economy is collapsing and internal demand and consumption is falling. So it's a question of how you look at this. From the rosy-tinted view of the European Commission, everything's fine and eventually we'll get there. But from the way that I look at it and other people look at it, what you have there is an economy that's decided to eat itself.
And let's talk about the evolution of this idea of austerity, because it has been around for quite some time. Where did it come from?
You have to honestly go all the way back to basically the origins of capitalism in England and the post-Civil War settlement and people like John Locke and then the Scottish Enlightenment of Smith and Hume and others. And basically you have this wonderful tension that goes on between markets and states. So the standard sort of Smithian story is that individuals create markets and the state's out there to try and steal your money. Well, there's a more sophisticated version if you actually read Locke and Smith and others. And what they basically acknowledge is the following. I'll quote Smith for a moment. Smith says that for every rich man, there must be 500 poor. And because of that, he is surrounded by jealousy. And if it wasn't for the strong arm of the magistrate, then basically his stuff would be stolen. So why do you need a state? You need a state to police the inequalities that untrammeled markets make possible. But here's the kicker. In order to be strong enough to do that, you need to have a state that's big enough and powerful enough to police those inequalities, which means you have to pay for it. And the trouble is you don't want to pay for it. So there's a dilemma at the heart of this. You don't acknowledge that the state makes markets possible, but it does. You don't want to pay for it, and you don't trust it. So here's a little wheeze that comes up. It's called government debt. How about the government pays you to lend it money? That'd be like a financial free option, the best of all possible worlds. But the problem is, by doing so, and this is the classical story from which austerity springs, the government has to offer you a rate of interest greater than you would get in normal pursuits. As a consequence, and this is the crowding out argument, all the money gets diverted into government debt rather than the real economy. We end up with more and more debt. We indebt ourselves, eventually become in hock to foreigners, and then eventually the economy collapses. So debt is at once an elixir and a poison. It's something which gets over this can't live with it, can't live without it, don't want to pay for it problem, but it ultimately creates its own problem, which is the indebtedness of the nation and the bankruptcy of the nation. Now, seen in that way, any government that grows too big or issues too much debt, whatever that threshold is seen to be, is on the road to ruin, and that's the inevitability, and that's where the idea comes from. There's just one slight problem with this rendition of events. It's not true. At the time that Hume wrote this, Britain was emerging from the Napoleonic Wars and had a huge amount of debt, and he thoroughly thought that Britain was going to be bankrupt. It went on to dominate the global economy for 100 years.
Now, and in the context of our economy in this country, there's even more problems with that story. I mean, do we have a sense of, I mean, I know that Reinhardt and Rogoff have basically come out and said that 90-some-odd percent of GDP is sort of the magic threshold where everything falls apart. But do we have any real sense that that's even an issue in the context of a post-gold standard world in this country? I mean, do we have any sense of, is there actually a point where that debt can bankrupt our country?
Well, that's an interesting thing about the Reinhardt and Rogoff study. I mean, basically everything you look at is either on a fix or on a gold standard. So if you have your own exchange rate and you can adjust to the exchange rate, this doesn't seem to be the case. It also is a case that size matters. When you are the United States and you issue the currency that everyone else has to earn in order to conduct foreign trade, it kind of changes the game. And we have a big natural experiment going on just now. You've got a bunch of countries in Europe all tied together that basically are about the same size as the United States, and they've been cutting their way to a depression. Meanwhile, the United States hasn't been doing that, and it's in a stuttering recovery, but at least it's in recovery. And the longer that takes hold, the more the divergence grows. So we do have a lot of evidence that this 90% thing really isn't true. The United States above 90% is growing a lot faster than Europe. So there's a bit of a chimera in that one to start with. But the key lesson here is what cures debt is growth. You can chip away at the nominal debt all you want. You can basically cancel government programs and send people home on furloughs and all this sort of stupid stuff. But at the end of the day, unless you're really, really willing to take 20%, 30% of GDP out of circulation, as the Greeks have done, and it hasn't done them any good whatsoever, you're just playing budgetary games. What gets rid of debt is growth. Consider the following. The United States hasn't actually paid back all of its debt from fighting the Civil War. People, you tell people this, they get shocked. You go, but think about the relative size of the United States economy then relative to it now. If my income doubles, the mortgage I've got now is half of the problem it was before. Growth cures debt. Cuts make debt worse.
Right. And in fact, our debt was a function, rather than the crashing of the economy being a function of debt, the debt was a function of the financial crisis.
Yeah, well, there's a long sort of process of accretion, and there is blame on both parties here. I mean, when you know you can issue the global reserve asset, you get lazy. Now, you know, I'm perfectly fine with basically paying back debt. I don't think you should have excessive debt, however you define this. If the United States doesn't have to pay hundreds of billions of dollars in interest, then perhaps it shouldn't, and then we'd have more money for investing in things we actually want. But when you do this, you do it when you're growing. And this is a Keynesian line, but it's also a very commonsensical line. The boom, not the slump, is the time for austerity. The problem is not the economics. There are no such thing as Keynesian politicians. No one, Democrat or Republican, stands up in the Senate and says, everything's going great, the economy's humming along, we're all making a fortune, let's raise taxes. That just never happens, and that's exactly what you're meant to do in order to pay back debt. So we don't do that. So we dig our own grave. The financial sector was, the financial bailouts were just the most egregious example of that.
Let me ask you, why do you think that this idea has not died, this idea of austerity? We see what it's doing to Europe. We now even have the IMF coming out and saying, hey, this is, we finally decide this is a bad idea. Why does it continue?
Well, part of it is because we've been living through, as people call it, the neoliberal era, whereby for 30 years we convinced ourselves that markets were good and states were bad, and states only ever got in the way and left to their own devices. People with skin in the game would make optimal choices, and boom, then you have the financial crisis. And in a sense, it takes people a while to realize that what this means is a lot of the ways that they thought about the world and the way the world worked is actually wrong. But more deeply, it resonates, because most people don't have the time to sit down and work out fallacies of composition, to figure out how the balance of payments works. That's all complex and time-consuming stuff, and also is error-prone. You ask the IMF for their forecast for 2004, I bet they said that 2008 would be a nice year. So, you know, let's grant some kind of, let's say, generosity to the common sense of the man in the street. But at the same time, common sense solutions can be deeply misleading, because it's deeply counterintuitive that current debt can lead to more debt if everybody tries it at the one time. So there's many reasons, and also there's ideological reasons. There are people out there like Grover Norquist who will do anything by any means necessary to drown the federal state in a bathtub, quote-unquote. So you add all this together, ideology, epistemic arrogance, laziness, time, and you end up with a bunch of people who say, well, you've got too much debt, just cut it. It's common sense. But yeah, but that common sense is a nonsense.
And just speak briefly as well about the so-called rebel alliance. One of the examples we hear quite a bit of austerity working is, among other places, Estonia. But that's not really an accurate depiction. And in fact, austerity, as in practice, aside from it being theoretically nonsensical, in practice, it has never worked to bring about any type of growth, has it?
Well, there are things that look like austerity that are often cited as examples. So you think about Canada and Ireland in the 1980s. These are the great cases. They basically cut their debt and they grew. Well, part of the reason they did this is because 75% of their exports each go to a country right next door, the United States and Britain, respectively. Those are big economies were expanding. The small economies are export-dependent. And they did a huge devaluation. The loonie lost 40% of its nominal value over a 10-year period. That's why you grow. It's not because of the expectations of consumers or people start spending more because they think they'll be paying less taxes in the future. It's a simple devaluation and real wage growth story. So that's part of the reason. We confuse things that aren't austerity effects for austerity effects. But the ones that are being hawked around now, you know, the success of the Baltics. I mean, the reason these guys had to be so austere in the first place is because they privatized their entire banking systems to the point that foreign banks owed their money supply. When the crisis hit in 2008, the Swedish and German banks threatened to pull all the money out of these systems, effectively pulling all the liquidity out of these economies. So in return for keeping the money there that was actually not theirs to start with, it was the depositors' money, the trick that was signed in Vienna in 2009 was to guarantee the balance sheets and bondholders of senior banks and senior bondholders of banks in Germany and Sweden by basically cutting the pensions of people in Estonia. They went through a huge, huge slump, and then they had a huge, huge bounce back. You know when the bounce back started? When they stopped doing austerity. Hmm. There are automatic stabilizers in the economy. People who say that, you know, intervention is a bad thing, they have a point, because cutting is an intervention too. It's symmetrical. You've got to have both sides of the story here. Spending's an intervention, but so is cutting. And when you cut, it's contractionary. There is no evidence that these things produce positive expectations of future growth. Quite the contrary. If you look at the Eurobarometer data, the most economically pessimistic people in Europe are the Latvians and the Estonians. So this story simply doesn't explain the case that it supposedly does.
All right. So finally, I mean, what will bring about the demise? Will we ever end this allegiance to this failed economic idea of austerity?
Unfortunately, what tends to do that is when the politics generated by it become extremely ugly. And we're not there yet, but the warning signs are already there. You have Golden Dawn in Greece. You have Beppe Grillo, who's basically the unfunny version of Stephen Colbert, being the kingmaker in Italy. You've got ructions in Spain continuing, a collapse in the vote of the major centrist parties that have been the main sort of bastions of democracies in these supposedly stable countries. Let's remember that what happened in Germany in the 1920s and 1930s, in closing, the Germans will tell you the stories about the inflation, but the inflation ended in 1924. And between 24 and 28, Germany was one of the more stable and prosperous and growing economies in Europe. A lot of it was borrowed American money, and that money went flying out in response to the Wall Street crash. And at that point in time, the Germans had no alternative because they thought the way to go was to cut. So they started to cut, and they started to cut, and they started to cut. And a very minor party called the National Socialists, who were polling less than 10%, suddenly got 18% of the vote. And then they were in the 20s, and then they were in the 30s. And then by 1933, by the time that Adolf was elected, they had 43% of the vote. So we should be very, very careful in these Panglossian estimates of just another 5 years of chronic unemployment, misery and suffering for people at the bottom of the income distribution. Because at the end of the day, they will protect them themselves, but they will protect themselves in the worst possible way for all of us.
All right. Well, Professor Blythe, I appreciate your time today. I know that you are strapped for time. And I'd love to speak to you.
Going to run for the Amtrak.
Yes, we'd love to speak to you again in the future. Thanks for taking the time today.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Introducing whiny-ass, teeny-baby conservatives to the truth. Wow, wow, conservatives. That's you crying. The left just got a little bit louder on The Majority Report.
Let's go to the phones. John from California. Welcome to the program, John.
Hi, this is John from California.
Hi, John.
And I was calling in because a fellow member of our Libertarian Party had turned Democrat by listening to your show. She said, yeah, he seems to have a pretty good grasp on his economic situation. So she had me listen in, and I'd like to debate you on everything you've ever said at all. It just seems to me like you have a superficial economic grasp of all that's going on. And the first thing I'd like to ask you is, when has regulation ever worked? You always seem to say, when has free market never worked? When has regulation ever worked?
When has regulation...
Go ahead and give me any example.
Do you have diarrhea right now?
Well, no. I'd like to talk on an economic,
philosophical. You asked me a question. You asked me a question. When has regulation ever worked? And I'm asking you a question.
Yes, and it is far prepared economically or encouraged during government policy. When has regulation ever worked?
Well, are you suggesting that we didn't have massive economic growth from the 40s and the 50s and the 60s?
I'm saying that's when we had less of the Fed involved in our economics and it gave us
a chance. Well, but regulation was working. Then regulation has nothing to do with economic growth because we had it then, didn't we?
Economics has nothing to do with... Sorry, repeat the question?
Wasn't a question. You asked me, when have we ever had a booming economy with a regulatory state? And I just answered you.
In the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Yeah.
I would say that we could have had a bigger economic growth without any regulation. But, yes, we did have an expansive period between
okay.
those periods.
Well, I've answered your question. Do you have any others?
No, what? That doesn't answer my question.
Okay, so because maybe you got to repeat your question to me again because obviously I didn't understand it.
When has regulation ever worked economically or philosophically or anything?
Okay, well then let me, if you're going to include philosophically in this, let me go back to my first question to you. Do you have diarrhea? If the answer is no, it is because
diarrhea.
We have regulations that make sure the water that you get out of your tap is clean.
I live in Sacramento, and I live on the outskirts, and I have my own well, so I don't know. That doesn't apply for me.
Okay.
I don't have fluoride in my water. I get my water tested on a daily basis, so
you know,
that argument is debunked, and I think
okay. All right, let me ask you this:
water systems
do
is
you
not really
in your rural area?
Probably
hold on for a second,
for
John, in your rural area, do you have electricity?
Do I have electricity?
Yes, I mean, do you generate your own
electricity?
Yes, we
have electricity through a municipal utility district.
Yes, and do you think that that is regulated? Do you think that regulations...
It's regulated on a local level per taxpayer and per voters around here. Yeah,
okay,
we regulated ourselves.
You got to get more
it's
specific.
Not regulated
so in
on
other words for
level.
You, what you're talking about is when is
it's
federal regulation?
That us and our community have levied together. We've levied our money, and we've passed this initiative, and it's working.
Right. Okay, so what you're talking about is federal regulation. You got to get more specific here because you keep changing the goal. So when is federal regulation?
No, you can give me any specifics you want as where regulations work, but we're regulating ourselves.
Oh, you guys are completely autonomous. There's no state regulation on your utility?
I'm sure there's state power laws or whatever that apply to the utility districts, but we as voters get to set prices and whatever else is fair. This is SMUD.
This is what?
SMUD, Sacramento Municipal Utilities District.
Okay, and you don't think they're subject to any federal regulations?
Going, though.
Okay, all right. Well,
this also could be a private company.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a bunch of investors getting together for a product.
Right. And they're not subject to any federal regulations, as far as you know.
We're not. Your argument is that we're not. Yeah, of course we have to apply under federal regulations. I'm sure some kind of Securities Exchange Commission Act and the Department of Corporations and under state federal law. But I'm saying that these regulations at this state and federal law have done nothing but hurt us. I mean, they've imposed more cost on us as SMUD, as the utility payer.
Okay, and so what about planes? Do you have any planes that are falling in out of the sky? I mean, do you perceive, like, FAA regulations? That
so FAA could be organized as a private institution, too. I'm not saying let's privatize all government because I'm libertarian. I believe in limited government.
Limited government.
In the case of a free market economy. Well, let's use the case of planes. In the case of planes... Obviously, you can't have competition in the air without regulation. They couldn't regulate themselves. Is that your argument? We need the government?
Yeah.
Because why? I don't understand, because planes are going to crash into each other if we don't have the government. That's your argument? If we don't have the FAA, they're just going to stupidly crash into each other.
Well, no, I think that if we don't have...
Well, you don't think that they have a economic enterprise to protect their investment.
Whom? Who? I would say that the big industry players would basically say, we're going to get the right of way. And we're going to, the big player would probably monopolize it if they would be able to, if they would band together with no regulation.
Well, we're getting into semantics there, but I'd like to get back into any other libertarian argument.
Okay, well, you were the one who wanted to do regulation. You tell me.
It's been an expensive period with non-regulation. I mean, I don't understand your point. You think more regulation is good?
I think...
And I would like to cite many cases where...
I don't think more regulation is good. I don't think less regulation is good. I think that good regulations are good. That's what I think is good. I don't think regulations for the sake of regulations...
You seem to forget economic cases since the 17th century, starting with Adam Smith, that, quote, good intentions by the government end up hurting the people. You are so... far gone on your economic policies. I don't understand where you think that regulation completes itself in the initiative.
That what? Regulation what? Completes itself
regulation
in the initiative?
It's a good intention, but it never ends up doing what it's supposed to do.
Really? Never? You don't think it keeps our skies safe?
We're subsidizing.
You don't think it keeps? I mean, I listen. Yesterday,
line,
I had.
There's no other privatized company we can go to.
I had yesterday. I took a walk with my daughter along the Hudson River, which several decades ago was completely poisoned. But government regulation has cleaned it up.
Well, that's where me and you would agree as a libertarian. I see a lot of people on your show. Well, I'm not this kind of libertarian. I'm libertarian. So I believe in a limited government.
Okay, what does that mean? Limited to what?
Corporations or private companies or whoever, the government pollutes the river, we should use the law system to enhance some kind of...
Well, regulations are laws. That is what the law system is. When the EPA...
That is what the law system is what?
What is the law system? What is that? I don't know what that is. What is when you say law system?
The
what is
court's
that?
In place, so I don't know if the Hudson. I'm on the West Coast. I'm in Sacramento, so I can cite new cases over here. But I'm sure all the court systems in America work the same. You can sue at a local level through tort reform,
and
you can sue
tort reform that you sue through.
Level. You can sue at a federal level. I don't understand what your question is. The courts in place, I think we should still have.
Right, the courts we have in place now. What do you think that they adjudicate based upon?
Adjudicate the makeup on probably previous cases. That's probably case law.
Case and law, no and then there's cases, law law.
That's how it works.
Statutory
law. The law system with me?
Like you're not allowed to dump your stuff in the river anymore.
So I just told you I agreed with limited government. But what's your question? We shouldn't be allowed to dump stuff in the river? Even if we had no EPA in place, somebody dumping something in the river hurts the community as a whole, and they can get together and file a civil lawsuit, whether in a tort, in a civil lawsuit, or they used to be able to.
Are you familiar with the Cuyahoga River?
The EPA takes that right away.
Are you familiar with the Cuyahoga River?
To do that for them.
Are you familiar with the Cuyahoga River?
EPA is sort of the government's representative of the people.
John, can you hear me? Are you familiar with the Cuyahoga River?
Are you bringing up different case by case, or what? I don't understand. Let's go on with the Hudson River. Let's complete your thought there, whatever you were trying to say.
Well, I can tell you that EPA regulations cleaned up the Hudson River, the Cuyahoga River, which was essentially one of the big impetuses to the EPA, literally on fire.
The EPA has done great, and I agree. Hey, okay. They could have done great there, and they've done great on the West Coast too.
Okay, so there's some regulation that you don't have a problem
with. They over-regulate, and they cause businesses to go down, which causes, it's just regulation. You cite these little cases, but that's what I'm telling you. The intention
well,
is
you
great.
Asked me to
but
cite
let's see what the EPA will come in 25
where regulation
years.
Was good.
What's that?
See, John, here's where we're why we're talking. Hold on for a second, John. Just calm down. John. Why don't you cite for me? Okay, I'll give you an opportunity, and I'm sure you can come up with one. I probably could come up with one. Can you cite for me a case where a business went under because of regulation?
Where businesses went under regulation?
Where a business went out of business because of regulation.
Sure. In California, the EPA passed the Clean Air Regulatory Law at state level. And what this did, it was a good idea. We took old machinery, old diesel trucks, and we added in kind of like a second catalytic converter. We've had a $3 billion decline in economy in California. $3 billion because of this regulation.
Now, how do you determine that?
I don't have the statistics on how much it's actually cleaned up, but the intentions were good.
Well, hold on, John, calm down, John. How did that work? How did California lose $3 billion because of the addition of a second catalytic converter?
How did California lose $3 billion? Well, it is economics, which you're not really that privy on when I'm talking to you. And I don't want to put you down, but...
Wait, I'm sorry. Could you just repeat what you said? It's economics that you're not that privy on?
The old machinery. Sometimes old companies, that's all they have is old machinery. And that'll put them out because it's not cheap to adhere to these smog laws.
Right.
And I don't see what your question is.
Well, I was just asking where you got...
$3 billion worth of revenue was lost.
$3 billion worth of revenue?
Do you want to divvy out specifically how it was lost and who it was lost from? I don't understand.
Well, yeah, I want you to substantiate your claim that $3 billion, the economy shrunk by $3 billion because of environmental regulations.
This was an article in Sacramento Business Journal, and it was an article about how it was basically on heavy machinery equipment, which this law targeted.
Okay, and so the Sacramento Business Journal said that it they
Business
caused,
Journal.
Okay, and did you do any more research after that? Did you see, like, for instance, how much more?
I'm a libertarian. This is economic policy. I'm just citing stuff off the top of my head because that's where you wanted to bring this. This isn't like a research policy. The EPA, you brought this up.
Right. Okay.
I'm telling you what I know about the EPA, but I would be happy to cite more research I do know about bigger government agencies.
Oh, please.
Doing what they think is right and actually doing what's wrong. I mean, it's F.A. Hayek, any economist you want to look at, even to Thomas Sowell, Milton Friedman. These people spell it out. Nobel Laureate Prize winners. I don't understand where your research has flopped there.
All right, you want to talk about
the other... criticize things like the welfare system and... bigger issues we should be talking about here.
All right,
rather than you trying to cite two things that the EPA did on the West Coast.
Okay, well, why don't you tell me what it is that you want to... we can talk one more topic. We've got time for one more topic. What is it that you want to... Where do you want to plant your flag here?
Well, you know, you drew away a liberal. I mean, you drew away a libertarian to a liberal, and we're pretty close on some issues. I think... you know, especially family or whatever. You should be able to choose what you want. But I think you really misportrayed. She specifically told me that economic policy is just better than libertarians. Yeah. Regulation will bring about the things we want. And I just was kind of hoping you had an example of that.
Well, like, I cited them. Like, we have a clean river here in the Hudson is now clean. Less smog in California. Less asthma for kids. Less medical expenses borne by the state, a healthier environment.
You know, hold on. I'd like to stop you. You're stating these little specifics. I'm stating a government as a whole. Your argument is flawed. You're stating little points and you're misconstruing the argument. I would like you to stay on topic.
Okay.
What government that has regulated its people to the point as we regulate ours? Has ever prevailed?
What government has regulated the people to the point that we're regulating ours has prevailed? Well, I guess ours.
Economic theory. That's what we're talking about, economics. Economic policy.
Okay, Europe? Yeah, Europe. All of Europe.
Europe has failed. Failed completely. I don't know what you're playing at. That is so general. It's disgusting.
Well, you just asked me to list a bunch of governments.
Greece? Are you talking about Greece? Let's talk about Greece.
How about
Greece has overregulated
Brazil or China
themselves.
Or Singapore.
They have so much government they can't even pay for it. That is the economic reason that they are in the hole. That is what you're proposing. I don't know. Greek economics. We can look at anything else. What specifically are you saying about Europe?
Well, you asked me what governments have survived or prevailed. Japan.
Japan I don't know. Japan was a government was created by our government, the Wilson Institute, in the early 1900s after World War II. So that's modeled off of Free Economic Institute, which I am trying to vote for.
It was modeled after us.
You just said, wait a second.
We had big regulation. Yes, we had huge regulation. We created the Japanese government, dude.
Yeah, wait a second.
You create the jobs in government, Bill. Is that what you just said?
No,
oxymoronic, and that statement is so false. It's unbelievable.
The statement was literally false, as in that's not what I said.
Are you funding jobs? Are you subsidizing private companies? How do you define that?
No. I think you just misinterpreted.
You start saying these words, and we're supposed to salivate like Pavlov's dog, you know? Government creation of jobs. That is oxymoronic. Government doesn't create jobs. People create jobs.
Government doesn't create jobs. People create jobs.
Yes.
Well, who do you think is in the government?
Government does not create jobs. That is an absolutely 100% true statement. Government does not create jobs.
Really?
Examples of where government does create jobs.
You know, John, before you called in, John, while you were on the phone, like, John, just listen for a second.
That's where government creates
jobs. Quiet
for
a second. You just said government doesn't create jobs, right? I just read a piece from Josephine County in Oregon, where 23 of 29 deputies in Josephine County, sheriff deputies, had to be laid off because of federal funds that were cut off that were providing those jobs for those 23 sheriffs. And the other implications of that story is that a woman was raped because the sheriffs they didn't have anybody to send out to her. So don't tell me the government doesn't create jobs. Did you see in Oklahoma
citing a specific incident where a woman got raped somewhere and now I'm so fatality like Pavlov's dog again. You're creating this one incident and you're blowing it out of proportion because
wait a second.
There's no economic, there is no proof that these guys getting laid off caused this girl to get raped. And you're making that claim, you're making that leap, and I'm supposed to swallow it here. And I thought this is a real conversation.
But don't even look at don't even look at the rape part. He just said that federal funding cut cost those 23 sheriffs their job. Just look at that. Forget the girl getting raped.
Government.
How does that not prove that government
you're
creates
that's
jobs?
The cause of the girl getting raped is because the sheriff.
Who's government creates jobs? For Christ's sake! Go to the freaking learning annex.
I can't take this. Hey guys, stop it. Stop it, John, let me apologize.
Let me apologize
for how rude my two producers just were to you. Let me just apologize.
Destroyed my meditation retreat effect, sir. This stupidity
is over an hour. Stop. I'm going to cut your microphones. John, I apologize for how rude my producers were.
I'm just trying to wonder, though, like where the thinking is. You're thinking that nobody gets raped where there's lots of police?
No, John, I'm sorry.
We've
gotten off point.
I
shouldn't have brought that second part in. All I can tell you is that the sheriff's department says that they have cut 23 jobs from a 29-person sheriff's deputies force because of the cuts in federal funding. Let's just keep it on that terrain.
Okay.
Now, would you concede... I understand this is just a specific, and you want some type of broader, non-specific, non-tangible example. But just indulge me. In that instance, the federal government had created 23 jobs.
For who?
What?
You're going to have to cite what you're saying. The government cut these 23 young gentlemen from the local employment, right?
No, but the federal government didn't cut. The federal government was providing funds. Listen, okay. All right, I want you to write this down, okay, so that you can Google it. It'll be really easy.
I don't want to Google it. I just want to hear what you're saying.
All right. All right, you're going to have to listen now. The sheriff's department cut 23 of its 29 deputies because of cuts in the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act, which provided funding to this county to hire police officers and other county
workers. Okay, let's stop right there, because we can break it down from what you're saying. 23 cops got fired. They hired them back on through some act or fund. That act and fund is paid by the taxpayer. So you really didn't create any jobs that's being subsidized. It's another subsidy. So that in and of itself, I can stop you right there. You don't even need to go any further.
So those aren't, what do you define as jobs?
They're not being funded out of thin air. They're being funded out of mine and your pockets. And it's not such a bad thing to employ 23
But you know what? You know what? I got news for you, John. I am being subsidized by the people who pay for this show.
What's being subsidized?
John, all right, listen. The problem, John, quiet for a second. I've given you a lot of time here. John, quiet for a second. The problem is that you simply have an ideological problem with taxpayers funding government and then government hiring people. You decide to say that that's not jobs, it's subsidies. This is a meaningless distinction to me, and you can take that for what it's worth. You can say that I'm an ideologue because I don't have a problem with taxpayers funding the government and then the government hiring people to provide us services.
Where is the earmark?
You ideologically, you are trapped.
Going somewhere else? Or is that going back to the taxpayer's pocket, which I guarantee you it's not? It's a mismanagement of government.
You, John, and I've muted you so the people know, you have an ideological problem with people paying taxes and the government redistributing that money to pay for police services, fire services, the FAA, the EPA, the FDA, all of these government agencies. You have an ideological problem with that, and so you decide that you're not going to define the people hired by that money as having jobs. Well, that's fine. You're just making up words. That's the problem. I'll give you the last word, John, but it's got to be quick. Go ahead.
The federal government should not be in charge of the police, the fire department, and, I don't know, civil servants within the local level. I think you're mistaking that. Somehow they get earmarked through certain funds.
Right.
I can concede that.
Yes.
That is controlled. Both sheriffs are elected at a local level.
Right. Great last word, John. Got to jump now. Got to jump. But feel free, John, feel free to call back. But I got to let you go. I got to let you go. Call back anytime, John, but I got to let you go. All right, I got to let you go. But I'll call back anytime, all right? I got to continue on with the show. Free market demands it. So as you know, CPAC has wound down. And aside from people getting the Breitbart Award there, or I don't know, the last great Breitbart memory we had came from CPAC, where he was yelling, "Behave yourselves! Behave yourselves!" And we no longer have Breitbart to remind us to behave ourselves. This heartwarming story of of CPAC attempting to raise awareness amongst conservatives of just how much they need to extend outreach to people of color and to people who are not like themselves. And so they held a little workshop on how essentially, I mean, I don't even know what the name of it is, of the workshop was.
It's actually literally something along the lines of
not, you know, if you're tired of being called racist when you're not racist.
Right.
Like that,
yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It's like how not to be called a racist. And it was hosted, or at least one of the presenters was Carl Smith of Frederick Douglass Republicans. I guess that's an organization. He is an African-American. He was explaining to all of these conservatives, basically, how we should perceive conservatives should and open ourselves to African-Americans because, you know, we don't do very well electorally with them.
The name of the panel was Trump the Race Card.
Trump the Race Card. Just built into that is this sort of like, you know, how you're going to play poker with how you're going to play poker with people who think you're a racist and prove to them that you're not. You know, it's really not that hard.
Not even prove to them. Show them you're not.
Right. It's not that hard to show it if you're not. It's sort of just sort of like the absence of your racism sort of speaks volumes. And, and the problem is they had is that they couldn't even get this workshop going without the absence of racism. Because in the middle of this presentation by Carl Smith, a gentleman got up, a man named Terry, who had a Rick Santorum sticker and attended CPAC with a friend who wore a Confederate flag emblazoned T-shirt. And Terry got up in the middle, Scott Terry, I should say, 30 years old, from North Carolina, and had this to say in this exchange.
It seems to me like you're reaching out to voters in that field program that you're offering us at the expense of young white Southern males like myself, my demographic.
So I don't know if you would have heard he said here. He said, it seems to me that you're reaching out to these other voters at the expense of me, of white Southern guys. Now,
if there's anybody the Republicans are not speaking to.
Well, I mean, aside from the ridiculousness of that, but for this guy, it's a zero-sum game, and that's the problem the Republican Party has, right? Is that they cannot, in terms of their DNA, actually outreach, because the idea of outreach is necessarily, in their minds, you're taking something away from me.
I study literature, English literature and stuff, and as I read about the past, I really came to love my people and my culture.
Okay.
And that, I know that's anathema. I mean, I know that's
no, it isn't.
Bad to say.
So,
okay.
Nobody said that.
Yeah, so,
okay,
so my question would be, I mean, I feel like my people, my demographic, are being systematically disenfranchised.
Okay. Yeah.
And furthermore, you know, people like the lady over in the red shirt applauded and said, yay, that's good. My problem is, why can't we be more like Booker T. Washington Republicans and his famous statement, let's be unified like a hand, but separate like the finger.
Okay.
So what he's saying here is he wants to be more like Booker T. Washington, which is basically, in his mind, it's be like the hand. We're unified at the hand, but we're all separate fingers, which means that we all go into our silos. Now, I don't know, even if you have that philosophy, how it is that outreach, electoral outreach by your Republican Party infringes upon that, or as he says, it infringes upon his notion about love and his people. After he read all this literature about white people, he came to love them. And so this was the response by Carl Smith.
The question is, why can't we be more unified by Booker T. Washington Republicans versus Frederick Douglass? They call Booker T. Washington the second Frederick Douglass.
Mm-hmm.
The Frederick Douglass was the originator. Okay? So when you study Douglass, Douglass was not...
How about the unity and diversity?
What about it? Douglass talked about that. Give me an example. Here's an example. When Douglass escaped from slavery, I think 10 years or 20 years after he escaped from slavery, he writes a letter to his former slave master and says, I forgive you for all the things you did to me.
Forgiving him and shelter and food, all those
things?
Now we should pause it because I want you to know why everybody in there was aghast. Because
Carl Smith is saying that what Frederick Douglass did is that he, 20 years after he was a slave, apparently at the Frederick Douglass Republicans don't do really granular research on their namesake. But 10, 20 years later, after he was a slave, he wrote back to his former slave owner and said, "I forgive you," in pursuit of this unity but diversity. And the guy in the crowd says, "Oh," he said, "I forgive you for giving me food and shelter." And the amazing thing on this video is you can see there's a woman sitting two seats and she's just a cat. She can't believe what this guy is saying. I mean, they are just like, and the funny thing is that this is how out of touch those people in that room are. They're shocked that somebody would say this. But in fact, to us, it's sort of like, this is what the problem is. There's a reason why you need to hold this seminar, folks, about just, it's not, what can we do to help the plight of African Americans? How can we enfranchise them? How can we have a society that is more integrated and more support? It is, how can we trump the race card? Continue on with this reaction.
Let me ask you this question. Gonna move on.
I'll let people throw stuff.
Well, you said stop all my people.
Sir,
that's all right. That's all right. I'm one of your people.
Let me address this.
I don't think about the lady.
Okay, listen up.
So mayhem ensues. We don't need to follow all that there. But basically, the guy's saying, I'm one of your people, speaking of all the people who are in there. And apparently Think Progress caught up with this guy who said he'd be fine with African-Americans who were, if they were permanently subservient to whites. He also claimed that African-Americans should be allowed to vote in Africa. And that all the Tea Parties were as concerned with the same racial problems that he was. No way to know if that's exactly correct. But the funny part is, apparently, Carl Smith went on to say, released the statement, and reserves the brunt of its criticism for the female reporter who raised objections to the comments being made in the room. In the middle of my delivery, he says, while discussing the 1848's Women's Rights Convention, I was rudely interrupted by a woman working for the Voice of Russia. She abruptly asked me how many black women were there. So that was, as far as Carl Smith could see, was the biggest problem in the Trump the race card workshop.
That was what the whole room said. I've read articles where Think Progress or Talking Points Memo interviewed attendees of that panel, and they said, oh, everything was great. That young man had a great question until that black liberal woman had to interrupt.
Yeah, there you go. I would say that the workshop, on balance, I'd probably give it somewhere around a C or a D for effectiveness. So Tom Corbett, whose poll numbers in Pennsylvania are not so good, knew. And part of the reason is because Pennsylvania is feeling the pinch of all the cuts. The economy's going backwards there. Corbett tried to push in a classic Republican agenda, was successful in some instances, and now he's got to explain why economic growth in Pennsylvania is flattening out, why the number of jobs is starting to shrink there. And this is how he goes about and does it. He goes on a local radio show, and here he is.
Get them trained for the jobs of the 21st century and not the 20th century. That takes a while to get done. But we're in the process. There are many of the community colleges that now that are adapting. I believe Mansfield in the state system of higher education is adapting to get more certificate-type programs. So there is a need.
Now, let me just stop you here, because what Corbett did in the past 2 or 3 years in Pennsylvania is to cut community colleges by over 10%, to cut public higher education by 15%. 20%. Hammer this. So when he says these community colleges need to adapt to provide for a different job training, what he's really saying is that they can barely keep their heads over water now. But the idea that they're going to retrofit themselves and change their programs in midstream to adapt to a supposed changing economy, that's insane. Now, if you're Tom Corbett and you have just raised the issue of higher education and community colleges need to adapt and change, and then you realize, oh, wait a second, I've just made a mistake here because I sat upon some of the most deepest cuts to higher education in this state in generations. I better pivot. How am I going to pivot? Oh, my God, I'm reaching for straws here. What's the worst thing I could pivot to? I know. Here's the worst thing I could say.
Yeah, the other area is there are many employers that say, you know, we're looking for people, but we can't find anybody that has passed the drug test, a lot of them. And that's a concern for me because we're having a serious problem with that.
High on a hill was a lonely goat herd. Oh, lay, God. Lay, lay, lay.
Go! Yes. They're all high. The last refuge of a guy who has decimated his state's economy with austerity programs and giving tax cuts to the wealthy. Go! They're all high, ladies and gentlemen.
They can't find anyone who's not...
There's nobody work. At the end of the day, when you can... that's basically... Now that Reinhard Rogoff is been debunked, the only argument for austerity... We'd spend more money, but everybody in Pennsylvania is on drugs. They're all high. Why should we?
Bong sales in PA must be going through the
roof. Oh, through the roof. I don't know what to say about this. Alex Jones, apparently, had called for the deportation of Piers Morgan. Not necessarily a bad idea, but... because of, I guess Piers Morgan said, hey, this is crazy. Why do you have all these guns? And Alex Jones, he didn't like that at one bit. So in a desperate attempt to increase their ratings, because look, here's the bottom line. And I've said this many times before. If you, I mean, in New York, many times, there are a lot of people, sadly, with severe mental problems who walk the streets of New York City and frankly, other towns. But and often people will stare and will watch crazy behavior. You rarely see people who are crazy watching people who are not crazy. And CNN understands this dynamic, so they invited Alex Jones, apparently, to their New York studios. And Alex Jones got on there in a one-on-one interview with Piers Morgan. There are other places where you can go online, and you should watch the entire thing. But here's a little snippet of it. As Alex Jones goes in, Piers Morgan didn't have really a chance to ask any questions or get into any meaningful dialogue, but it is pretty amazing. But here's just a short clip of Alex Jones on the Piers Morgan show.
Piers, thanks for having me.
Why do you want to deport me?
Well, we did it as a way to bring attention to the fact that we have all of these foreigners and the Russian government, the official Chinese government. Mao said political power goes out of the barrel of a gun. He killed about 80 million people because he's the only guy that had the guns. So we did it to point out that this is globalism and the mega banks that control the planet and brag that they've taken over in Bloomberg, AP, Reuters, you name it, brag that they're going to get our guns as well. They've taken everybody's guns but the Swiss and the American people. And when they get our guns, they can have their world tyranny. While the government buys 1.6 billion bullets, armored vehicles, tanks, helicopters, predator drones, armed, now in U.S. skies, being used to arrest people in North Dakota, the Second Amendment isn't there for duck hunting. It's there to protect us from tyrannical government and street thugs. Take the women in India. Your piece earlier on CNN I was watching during Anderson Cooper's show. didn't tell you that the women of India have signed giant petitions to get firearms because the police can't and won't protect them. The answer wait a minute. I have FBI crime statistics that come out a year late, 2011. 20%+ crime drop in the last 9 years. Real violent crime because more guns means less crime. Britain took the guns 15, 16 years ago. Tripling of your overall violent crime. True, we have a higher gun violence level, but overall mugging, stabbings, deaths. Those men raped that woman in India to death with an iron rod 4 feet long. You can't ban the iron rods. The guns, the iron rods, Pierce, didn't do it. The tyrants did it. Hitler took the guns. Stalin took the guns. Mao took the guns. Fidel Castro took the guns. Hugo Chavez took the guns. And I'm here to tell you, 1776 will commence again if you try to take our firearms. Doesn't matter how many lemmings you get out there on the street begging for them to have their guns taken. We will not relinquish them. Do you understand? That's why you're going to fail, and the establishment knows, no matter how much propaganda, the Republic will rise again when you attempt to take our guns. My family in the Texas Revolution against Santa Anna, my family was at the core on both sides starting that because Santa Anna came to take the guns at Gonzales, Texas. Pierce, don't try what your ancestors did before. Why don't you come to America? I'll take you out shooting. You can become an American and join the Republic.
You finished?
Yes, I am finished. You will not take...
All right, he wasn't finished at all, actually.
That was a gracious offer at the end.
Yes. That was very nice. I would love to see those guys go out hunting together. Now, like I say, that was just a part of the clip of Alex Jones on CNN. But that's not all, ladies and gentlemen, because Alex Jones then went home and, he didn't go home. He went back to his hotel, and he issued this dispatch from his hotel room.
Alex Jones here in New York City, and as you know, just about an hour ago, I was on for 2 segments with Piers Morgan on CNN. They had promised me 3 segments if I came here, and then I was going to debate Alan Dershowitz, but they panicked. The producers ran in.
I'll tell you something. That is something I feel that the American public should not have been denied of. Alex Jones and Alan Dershowitz. I hope it was going to be, I hope they were going to strip naked and actually wrestle in mud. That would have been the best.
The head producer was crying and saying it wasn't supposed to be like this. And Piers Morgan said, get out of here. And their security people were like, get out now, you're coming with us. And I said, well, I have to get our stuff out of the green room. That said, you know I've covered Bilderberg. You know I've covered Occupy Wall Street. I've covered the DNC, RNC. I've been in news coverage where people are being arrested en masse. I never put out a video asking for people to watch our back. We got here today at about 4 o'clock, drove in from the airport into Midtown. Near CNN's main complex. They have several buildings.
I love how he says, like, main complex. You know, everything is sort of like, it's a main complex. It's just, it's a building, like all the other buildings around here.
And when we got to the hotel, we were getting our cards, and I noticed what was clearly off-duty cops in the windbreakers with the, you know, guns, talking into their little earpieces. They had earpieces and the little handheld pieces. And I didn't say anything to Rob Dew, who's running camera right now. Then about 2 hours before, after dinner.
Now, let me just tell you something about New York City. To go through a day and not seeing undercover cops, because in particularly at places like CNN, when maybe like the mayor has showed up, or maybe there's somebody, you know, I mean, that is the most common thing to see, I think, in New York City. But I understand.
Before we went down to CNN Center, we were walking around about 10 blocks away just shooting video of this and that, and I noticed more undercover cops looking at us. And I said to Dew, I said, let's just go ahead and get out of here. And then they had them waiting for us about 300 yards from CNN, the building we were going to, when the guy runs up and kind of gets in our face. And we also ran into a few listeners as well, but this guy got in our face. You can tell it was a, you know, big, mean Bloomberg detective. I've been here at protests before. I've seen Luke Radowski's videos. And it was like, oh, I'm a big fan, but it was like pure violence in the eyes. And Dew's like, man, that guy was scary. I think that's a cop.
Now, I got news for you. The proportion of Alex Jones fans of people who have like big scariness in the eyes, like violence in the eyes, I would say probably pretty high. One can only imagine what was going on in this guy's eyes. Now this fan goes home. He immediately watches this video, and then he furiously starts to write, "Dear Mr. Alex Jones, I'm actually a fan. Don't ever contact me again through email. I have some special instruction for you. You're going to be my secret agent. I want you to infiltrate the Bloomberg police department. Send me back messages through a carrier pigeon. Otherwise, the Bilderbergers will get hold of it. The Illuminati and the Rothschilds, which Piers Morgan is obviously working for them." This is unbelievable. I got to say, though, if Alex Jones is just a con man, he is also a wonderful performer. I mean, he strikes me as someone who's genuinely off his rocker. But if he's not, then I think he's even more legit, frankly.
He meets you. He's like, "Hey, Sam, how's it going?" Yeah.
I mean, I still think that if Alex Jones didn't exist, the CIA and any secret organization would have to create him just to throw everybody off the trail. But fortunately, he's out there to sort of confuse people and disempower people. It's the Bilderbergers. There's no other explanation. It's not just rich people who have aligned interests. No, it's a secret society where they burn skulls and do it in the desert. Then use the UN as a vehicle in which to take over everybody. If you buy my DVD for $19.95 and get the added hot plate coolers and drink coolies now at the Alex Jones store, you will see the connections between the Bilderberger Group and the United Nations, and how Morgan Piers is sending out undercover policemen to, that's right, I call him Morgan Piers, and he knows why. He knows why I call him that.
I just have to say, the fact that you're implying that that Alex Jones himself is some type of CIA front almost is...
No, I'm not implying that he is. I'm implying that if he didn't exist, he would have to be created. Okay. So as there's no better way to keep citizenry from understanding what's going on with their government than throwing out a guy who's got far more entertaining explanations and far more simplistic. It is us be them. It is the black helicopters versus the rest of us. And 1776 is going to come back and buy my Alex Jones coolies.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice was made for the option where you don't get paid.